Joe Gelonesi with you. Good to have you along. Now time for another conversation between Clive James and the great poet Peter Porter. This series takes us through the books and the writers who informed, inspired and enriched these two writers. The dialogues were recorded by Jill Kitson for her Book Talk program and first broadcast in the year 2000. Today it's the classical age, the 18th century in music and literature. Here's Clive James to begin today's discussion.
Peter, Shakespeare was so reluctant to go away from our last discussion that we got well into the 17th century and I never even mentioned my touchstone poet for the period, which was John Donne, who lives in my mind almost every day as I sit down to write. And I imagine if we got through the 18th century without you mentioning your touchstone poet, it'd be a disaster for you. Am I at liberty to guess who that might be?
Well, shall I tell you, so you don't have to guess? It would be, of course, Alexander Pope. But at the same time, I would point out that if I had to name the three greatest poets in English that I certainly feel are the greatest, I would start with Shakespeare, of course. Then I would have Pope, then I would have Donne. So in a way, of course, they are, as it were, outriggers to each other in that respect. And, of course, the thing is about Pope, which is so magnificent, he's the only perfect English poet. I mean, if you regard most Italian poets as having a kind of natural perfection of language, they may not be very interesting, but they've got that natural perfection. Very few English poets, because of the nature of the English language, have quite such a mellifluousness. Pope is the only one, and he had a syntax with the absolute complete control. But I think it's also worth pointing out that the Augustan age is badly named. It's much more an age of dead dogs floating down the Thames than it is an age of distinguished people writing pastoral in Palladian houses. And I think that one has to bear in mind that the artificiality of the heroic couplet and of the work that both Pope and Swift did does not mean that the land and the quality of life they're dealing with is in any sense artificial.
I think in American beauty contests for young ladies, there's a talent section, and those who haven't got any talent present a sort of semi-talent like packing a suitcase. Now, in many ways, Pope reminds me of someone who packs a suitcase beautifully. It's nothing could be neater and more accomplished and beautifully assembled, but just how much is there in it of human experience?
I think there's a great deal. There's also a kind of weird, magical strangeness as well. I mean, Auden one time contrasted Dryden, who, of course, I suppose was one sense Pope's model, with Pope, and he points out that Dryden was very much a man of sense and that Pope was a man of mystery, and that Dryden couldn't have written lines like, "Here sighs a jar, and there a goose pie talks, and maids turned bottles cry aloud for corks." There is that kind of weird phantasmon, that sort of metamorphosis in Pope, that he sees the world as absolutely distraught, and to write a complete anti-epic based on just bad writing, as he does in the Dunciad, is surely a weird way of looking at the world. He was, I think, a great transmogrifier, Pope, and a very, very strange human being.
He's been with me since I began to read seriously in my late teens, and couplets like Remembrance and Reflection, How Allied, What Thin Partitions Sense from Thought Divide, they get into your memory effortlessly, and they never come out again. But I think he's one of those writers. It would be a deficiency, it would be a deprivation if we couldn't talk about his personality and physical circumstances, because unless you know that he was cut off by his physical nature, because he was had a tubercular spine and he was actually dwarfish, he was cut off by his physical nature from so much of human experience, and especially sexuality, some of the intensity that we find in him would be less remarkable. I think The Rape of the Lock is a wonderful, wonderful poem. But I think it helps to know that it's about teasing and not about fulfillment, because fulfillment is something he knew nothing about.
I think that's true, and of course his spitefulness comes out in his attitude towards women like Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, whom he one time befriended and then sort of turned against. There was recently a program on the Box here, which I recall, in which Pope and Gay were both mixed up in the South Sea bubble. They were, in fact, entrepreneurial types as well. There was a lot of misery going on among the people, and they were pretty well indifferent to that. I mean, they weren't Tories in the sense that people now think of Tories as Tories. What they were, however, were people who saw a kind of huge republic of letters, or if you like, a kingdom of letters, they wouldn't have minded one way or the other, which was menaced by dullness, menaced by incapacity, menaced by all sorts of things except good writing. Good writing writing alone was going to be the thing which saved the world.
And Pope expected to be paid for good writing, which was quite a thing to expect, isn't it, even in the present context. But he was, in a sense, one of the first artist businessmen. It's true to say, isn't it, he was practically almost the first, it wasn't practically, he was really the first poet ever to make a living of it.
Exactly, and he didn't have to do what, Ariosto and other chaps in Italy did, which is get on the right side of patrons. His patrons, admittedly, had to have them, but they had to pay him by subscription. He made his money on the Homer issues purely by subscription, and vast sums of money at that. And, of course, he turned it into a nice place to live, his grotto at Twickenham, his beautiful gardens. As you say, these were all perhaps compensations for his dwarfed frame. And it's interesting, in fact, that of all the poets in great British history, he has been the most frequently painted. There are in existence something like about 60 portraits of him because he was a very handsome man. He was a dwarf. He had to wear a brace. Ladies didn't want him, but he had a very handsome face. And so everywhere you go, you'll find portraits of Pope, busts of Pope, but of course they don't go below the bust.
His poetry, I think, is one of the literary events of the British or English 18th century that you can actually think of in the context of European refinement of the Baroque, the high Baroque, Rococo, yeah. The decorated, the filigree, the glistening mirrors. He fits into that.
But like all British poetry is seen from the continent, it is so much more realistic. The thing which you notice often with, if you read even French poets like Boileau, say, if you contrast Boileau, who's going on about the decorums of writing, and Pope, as a young man, going on in equally about the decorums of writing in the Essay on Criticism, Pope is so much more practical, so much more down to earth, so much less Parnassian. And I think this is the great thing about looking at both Pope and Swift, is that they are the master realists of our literature. They were writing in a deeply artificial form, the heroic couplet, or in the case of Swift, writing in octosyllabic couplets. But what they do, I mean, a poem like Swift's like Helter Skelter, which is all about the Irish attorneys on their horses riding around the assizes in the countryside, is a masterpiece of realism, as also is other set pieces in Swift, such as this London shower and what happens when a storm hits London and washes all the filth down. I mean, this is the sort of thing which simply would not have been conceived by a French poet.
Swift was very cloacal and didn't mind saying so. He's very much underestimated as a poet because he committed the capital crime of writing prose, didn't he?
Yes.
People do not realize quite often that Swift was a considerable poet, and if he'd never written a line of prose in his life, he'd be remembered as a poet.
Also a most moving poet. I find, in fact, the famous lines on the death of Dr. Swift, although comical, are also extremely touching. He gave the little wealth he had to build a house for fools and mad. I mean, he was aware of the blackness. And this is the other side of the 18th century, of course, which you begin to find intensified as you move through it. All that decorum, all that keeping everything to the classical could not last because the society wasn't like that from the South Sea bubble onwards. Every kind of horror was going on. And eventually you find that they begin to go mad. I mean, and the great change in the century is when madness, usually religious excessive madness, takes over, and you get via, first of all, Christopher Smart, a very great poet,
But he was a clinical case, wasn't he?
He was a clinical case, but he suffered from what they call heuristic madness. He was actually quite cheerful with it, that was even more annoying to most people, I think, because he would insist on people falling on their knees and praying with him in St. James's Park. And then you go on to Cooper, who was dismally mad, Calvinistically mad. And then you get Blake, who was enrapturedly mad, were all mad.
I think Blake probably drove other people mad, too. I would have hated to be around him. Although, strangely enough, more of his lines have got into my head than almost anybody from the century. We all know Tiger, Tiger. But stuff like, and priests in black gowns were walking their rounds, binding with briars my joys and desires.
Yes.
That gets to you no matter who you are. And there was something to be said for, he had a much looser attack, of course, when he was writing an English line, much more like conversation, because he is actually forecast romanticism in that way, that he's much, much closer, I think, to the spoken voice. Nobody ever spoke couplets, for example. Nobody speaks like Pope. And nobody really spoke like Swift except in the prose. But isn't it true about Swift that there's dark material trying to burst through all the time? And it does. Sexuality in Swift is a real event, and it's a very, very distorted event.
But I think sexuality is, after all, a broad church, as they say. And there's a lot of what I would call the sensitive and friendly side of sexuality in Swift as well. You won't perhaps find it in the poetry, where he concentrates mostly on the cloacal, as you say, and Celia, Celia, Celia shits, that sort of thing.
And I think it was D.H. Lawrence who pointed out how much worse it would have been if Celia hadn't.
That's quite it. Well, no doubt many people didn't at that particular time. But the same time, you look at the journals he addressed to his two ladies, Vanessa and Stella,
which are still mysteries to many academics. Do you realise that academics are still arguing about whether he was having love affairs with these women? Surely he was. When the code in the journals must be the easiest code to crack in the world. I enjoyed my cup of coffee with you yesterday. Looking forward to three cups of coffee in a row tomorrow morning before 10:30. But what kind of code is this, and why are people still puzzled by it?
Well, it sounds to be rather like boasting by code, actually. But I think that I always defend Swift against the idea that he was such a killjoy. He could create, certainly in Gulliver, he created, and also I think in A Modest Proposal, he created some of the most dismally accurate pictures of humanity you'll find anywhere. I mean, the famous passage where the king of Brobdingnag says to Gulliver, doesn't he, after Gulliver's been induced into boasting about the circumstances of European attainment, and the king says, you know, by your own confession, that seems that your fellow men are the most pernicious race of little odious vermin that nature ever permitted to walk upon the surface of the earth. This, you feel, is what Swift thought. But he also said Tom, Dick and Harry were not quite the same thing, and he encouraged companionship. He was a great friend, though he was also a faction man.
Yeah. I think the Gulliver's Travels is so great that it goes on adding different kinds of greatness as time goes on. One of the things that fascinates me about it is that it's not just... Let me take the case of, say, Lilliput. You feel that's not so remarkable. Once you get the idea of the big man and the little people, it develops quite logically. It's a great invention. It's no mystery why it's successful. But the flying island of Laputa, where the mad logicians talk their crazy talk, is a direct forecast of what happened to the 20th century with literary theory and so on. So in a way, that part of the book can only be appreciated in our context. And that's one of the signs of a great book, is that it goes on revealing meaning as time goes on. It doesn't grow less, it gets bigger.
Yes, in that third voyage, which is Laputa, Glugnag, Dub-dub-dribbon and Japan.
Okay, now spell Wynnum.
Yes, indeed. Well, for many years I tried to say you and him and you and him. And presumably that's what it is from.
That's probably it, yeah. Probably it's supposed to be a horse's whinny. Yeah. But,
of course, we've all noticed before this, it's been often promulgated, that the Swift gives longitude as well as latitude for these places.
Anyway, I interrupted you because you were talking about the third voyage.
The land of the Wynnums, of course, turns out to be in the Great Australian Bight. Well, after all, have you ever met another nation which worshipped horses so more effectively? I mean, and so Swift got it right, just as at the same time as, you know.
I've always had a feeling it's a terrible hidden confession that he becomes completely subject to the British upper classes like Lord Temple, that they were the horses that he admired, and the Yahoos were his own people, the Irish.
Well, he certainly felt that we, the English, if we put ourselves into his boots, behaved appallingly to the Irish. That didn't mean he liked the Irish. He didn't. Mm-hmm. And he had that kind of very odd forward thinking that humanity was a warped piece of timber, you know, the idea that's been put forward frequently. I think probably it comes in pretty well in most German philosophers as well. But that obliged all human beings in positions of power and privilege to do something to help those that were even more warped than themselves. He was desperately in favour of amelioration. At the same time, he knew that amelioration could not make you like people.
I think it was the condition of life that drove him mad. The actuality of human existence is what drove him nuts, because he was sensitive. But these are great writers, and they're very, very formal writers, and they lead you towards the man who's in many ways the most formal writer of the lot in his writings, and that's Dr. Johnson. But is he a great writer?
Not to me, he's not, no. I'm a very firm resister of Johnson. He is a very fine speaker, I think. That is to say, everything he says is memorable in a kind of conversational way.
But we get that recorded by Boswell, don't we, who is the great writer.
Who is a great writer. I mean, I think one of the secret documents, they're no longer secret, of course, because everyone's had them published, but that for me, the secret document of the 18th century are Boswell's journals, where, as Auden pointed out, a marvellous insight, I think, that you don't believe Stendhal because you feel he's posturing in his confessions. You do believe Boswell because he's trying to avoid telling the truth, and he's kidding himself. Some of those early passages when he's a young man in London, and then subsequently when he does the grand tour, and he insists on sleeping with Rousseau's mistress because he knows Rousseau is one of the big figures in he's so much a placemaker, so much getting ahead. I think it's a good thing for a writer to have a corrupt character if he's willing to go the whole way. Perhaps that's what Blake meant when he said if the fool would persist in his folly, he would become become wise.
As long as he's not making up for lack of talent with defects of character, I agree with you. It's great. I think it's a big advantage to a national literature, and it's a bit too early to talk about nationalism. That's really a 19th century phenomenon. Yeah. But it does help a national literature to be supplied from elsewhere. And England has always been lucky in that elsewhere is so close. Elsewhere is Ireland and elsewhere is Scotland.
Yes.
And it's impossible to imagine Boswell without him being an outsider and keen to observe, to get to London, to get to the action. The man who records the action because he's the man who doesn't fit, the one who's keenest to get in. Johnson's always making fun of him, but where would Johnson have been without him?
I think it's a great sadness that the British character seems always to want some panjandrum to somehow dignify the worst parts of its character. And this, is, I think, is what happens in Johnson. Johnson was also a brave man.
And he was also great company. His conversation, and without Boswell, we wouldn't have it.
Yeah.
But you can see what the attraction was. I think, I don't know whether it's recorded in Boswell or someone else recorded it, but there was this tradition as you crossed the Thames by your little boat, it was a ferry, that you shouted to the ferry going the other way, and you abused the people in it. It was raillery.
Yes.
And Johnson apparently was the great victor of these contests. Somebody made the mistake of insulting him as they were crossing the Thames. Yeah. And Johnson didn't shout back, he said back. His voice carried a long way across the water, apparently.
Yeah.
He said, "Sir, your wife, under pretense of keeping a bawdy house, is a receiver of stolen goods." Now, that under pretense is excellent, is it not?
You can
imagine that one going around the town. If television had existed, of course, he would have been the Gilbert Harding of his time, only more so.
I think the sadness about Johnson to me is that he was a very great thinker and a very fine moralist, but he wasn't a great artist. And poor unfortunate Boswell was actually a fine artist. You even find him doing strange things when he was trying to cure himself of whorehouse visiting and such like things when he was in Holland. Not only did he try to keep away from the brothels and leaping off ferries when he was on his way to them, but he also sat down every day and practiced on Johnson's instructions. 10 or 15 or perhaps 20 lines of heroic couplets to try and improve his style. The self-improvement in Boswell and the old Adam somehow enable him to give us a portrait of humanity which is so realistic and so true.
It was a would-be classical age, wasn't it? But reality kept bursting through. But there's no doubt about the classicism and how determined they were about it. And Reynolds was not only estimated himself above Gainsborough, for example, but was estimated so until quite recently. And yet, to me, Gainsborough is the living painter simply because of his impressionism, his sketchiness, his sheer lyrical response to women's clothes and so on.
I don't think it was a great age for painting, really, the 18th century. For me, it's the age of music. And it's England at that time.
Even in England, but then
even in England, because England at that time was, as the United States is now, I mean, in the 20th century, so many of the great European musicians found employment in America. In the 18th century, they came to London. I mean, Geminiani was here, Handel was here.
Haydn was here, wasn't he?
Haydn came at the end of the century. Mm. I mean, the point about, I think, about music, the great equivalent to English literature in the 18th century on the continent is the Lutheran church music of Johann Sebastian Bach.
Now, Bach is an 18th century figure, in fact, which we tend to think of him as earlier than that, or I do, but when is he fully active? At the beginning of the 18th century? Yeah.
No, he's really working from about 1707 right through to 750. I regard Bach as a great humanist. I don't see him as this extremely austere man. He's some of the most voluptuous music ever written.
I think
we found in his Lutheran cantatas.
If you listen to the cantatas, I think you've got no choice except to see him as a great penetrator of human character. People don't just sing notes, they sing characters. And
the interesting thing about music, of course, to me in this context, is that you cannot really equate it to literature because a piece of music can be fitted to an extremely poor text and yet be a great piece of music. But at the same time, it can be fitted to a very great text. You notice this in Bach's Passions. There are three different kinds of words set. There are the great words of the Bible itself. There are the great words equally of the chorales, that is the hymns, and then there are the very ungreat words of the interpolated arias. And yet Bach writes great music for all three of these forms. I think that the painting is where I find the 18th century disappointing. If you go to Italy, for instance, you've got Tiepolo and you've got Guardi, but you've lost that huge enthusiasm which was there right through for about 300 years. And English painting gets better, and French painting is pretty good. I mean, anyone who could be as good as Chardin or as Watteau is obviously going well. But I just feel that somehow or other, the 18th century begins to show the domination of the two arts of music and literature over and above the pictorial arts.
And music emerges as the international art for a very, very simple reason, isn't it? It's more transmittable. It's not tied to language. And Europe really becomes Europe artistically with the rise of music. You might think it's heading towards Vienna as an epicenter, but with the rise of someone like Haydn, this is a European figure without question. This affects everything, and especially affects everything that comes after it, doesn't it? The relationship between Haydn and Mozart, you can't talk about a lack of connection here. Yeah. I mean, Mozart knew about Haydn. Yeah. The studying the person who went before you is now going to become a phenomenon. And it's a conscious progression in art. People are actually thinking of art as something that progresses in a quite new way.
Exactly.
Nobody had thought of that before.
Mozart, for instance, was in the chapel, the Sistine Chapel, and he heard the famous Miserere of Allegri, and he had, of course, enough nows to immediately sit down and write it all down from memory. Not surprisingly, because it's an extremely simple and rather threadbare piece. But the interesting thing was that already, even in Mozart's time, things are beginning to dawn on people that art has a history, that music has a history.
I was interested in reading about Mozart to find that it was quite an accident that Vienna became the Mozart city. It could have been Munich. He offered himself to them, but they were too dumb to take him.
In a way, Vienna was always, I think, going to be the heart of things because of the imperial court was there. Music, more than any other art, needs, despite its great ramifications everywhere, needs a centre of excellence, and Vienna has been that for so many years. And that's what happened in Italy. The Italians lost that. Rome and Venice used to be the great centre, and then Rome, and they lost it because their whole society deteriorated at the effect of the Counter-Reformation, and they eventually all ended up abroad. I mean, so many came to London. Scarlatti and Boccherini went to Madrid. Everybody moved all around the place. Paris attracted many musicians, and that really gutted Italy. And I think the great thing about Vienna was that it kept drawing people in. And of all the great composers, only one was born there, and that was Schubert.
It is interesting how early Europe has became one place. It was artistically integrated before it was integrated in any other way. In fact, its greatest wars were yet to come. Its biggest death tolls, its most cataclysmic events were all to come. But integrated artistically, it already was by the end of the 18th century. And about the time Australia was being settled by the First Fleet, Mozart's operas were being premiered in Vienna and Prague. And it's really been that way ever since. We've always thought since then of Europe as a cultural unity affecting the entire world, and the wars breaking it up. That's one of the threats they make, is to present a discontinuity in civilization. Because really, do you think Mozart thought he belonged to everybody, to the whole world, or was he just working locally?
I think he did think he belonged to the whole world, but that's partly, I think, because up close, where he was working locally, he had so many rivals. And one way of thinking you're better than the rest of the people who are your opposition is to recognize that you're serving something rather grander than they are. And I think that he did appreciate that right enough. But I'm fascinated too by the idea that music really should be the great link in among the European nations rather than language, because if you have to make it language, it has to be French. And yet there's something stultifying about French as the great lingua franca. It didn't really make much difference to world literature, whereas the Italianate nature of music, which it really, and after we still to this day say Allegro, non troppo, and all that sort of thing, that the Italianate native music, nature of music, turned music into the lingua franca of European expression.
Peter Porter with Clive James. Next week, the final in the series, which traverses the 19th century, the age of Romanticism and the age of nationalism. You can find audio of the series on the RN website under Special Broadcasts in the drop-down menu. And you'll find a link there to Clive James's website, which has a wealth of his writings, audio and video. Bye for now from me, Joe Gelonesi.